Welcome to the Issue Is Podcast Extra. This is where we get a chance to talk to some of our favorite panelists and sort of expand the conversations. And this week we have a legend of comedy, one of the all-time greatest. Rolling Stone says you're one of the 50 all-time greatest stand-up comedians of all time. Margaret Cho is here. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you. I'm very excited. Thank you.
Excited to have her. And, of course, Margaret Cho, been around for decades.
It's crazy. It's really too long.
Star of her own show, star on so many different shows, star of different comedy specials. It's been a part of so many people's lives and been such a sense of joy and inspiration and really a trailblazer in the comedian world, especially for Asian Americans in the comedian world. And I know you're so beloved because of that. So thank you. It means a lot to have you here.
Thank you very much. That's wonderful.
So we'll start off with, you know, a fellow podcaster.
Yes.
Congratulations. Your podcast, aptly titled The Margaret Cho.
It's fun. I've done it before. I did a podcast in the dawn of podcasting in like 2012, 2013, like a very early, was like the rock paintings with the cave paintings of the podcasting era, very early podcasting. But it was, I really enjoyed it, you know, and I think there's an intimacy that comes along with podcasting that is really appealing to me. And so I've started it back up again, and I'm working with Irios, which is a woman-run, woman-employed, woman network, which I really am excited about.
And speaking of women, I don't know if some of our listeners might have just heard, you brought along some company with you.
I know, that's Lucia. She's made a little like yawning sound there, but that's my 8-month-old Chihuahua. Mix. She's a rescue, so we're not sure what she is.
And she goes everywhere with
she's
you?
She's just kind of in this bag around my neck, and nobody seems to mind.
As we just said,
she usually doesn't make any noise.
If
but she did
if
say
you
something.
Don't like dogs, you're probably not somebody we want to be friends with.
There's
anyways.
Something weird about you if you don't like dogs.
What do you have favorite podcasts?
I listen to My Favorite Murder, which I really love. I love the true crime podcast. Also, I listen to mostly true crime ones, which is like kind of morbid, but it's also like I think it's. It's really interesting. I think that women get a lot out of true crime podcasts because you really learn how to protect yourself, you know, and you learn how to kind of maneuver around in this world that is pretty hostile to women. So there's something to that. And there's a new one that I liked a lot called Red Handed. But I do think that we get a lot out of podcasting. We get a lot out of investigative journalism. And there's so many great people out there that were now becoming like their podcast like standards. They're like the giants. So I love that.
That's awesome. Let's talk a little bit about your background. Since we last had you on our TV show, The Issue Is, we actually started broadcasting in San Francisco. So we're now on in San Francisco as well, which, of course, is your hometown.
It's my hometown.
You grew up in San Francisco. Your parents... owned a bookstore that had a lot of gay books in it.
Yes, it was a gay bookstore in San Francisco on Polk Street in the 70s. They purchased it in the 70s and owned it throughout the 80s and the 90s. And so we witnessed a lot of change in the gay community. My first gay pride was 1978. And so, you know, it's an amazing thing to have come as far as we have in terms of gay rights and to see what we've done. And it's remarkable. I think it's really powerful.
I mean, could you have imagined back then the world as it is now?
I think that, it's something that I couldn't have imagined, but then I could have because people really change things. I mean, Harvey Milk really set the tone. And unfortunately, he wasn't around to see everything that happened. But it's amazing that I got to go back in 2008 and perform gay weddings in City Hall, which is, of course, where Harvey Milk was assassinated. So, you know, to be able to see that kind of change in my lifetime was really profound.
But it wasn't so easy for you as a kid. You've talked a lot about and been open about the fact that you were bullied a lot.
Bullied a lot, but also, you know, I also had this vague sense of, like, never really belonging anywhere. And, you know, this is kind of like, I think kids, you know, as I am queer also, there's a sense of, like, other kids know that you're different. And then so they want to somehow push you away. So that's kind of, I think, why a lot of... LGBTQIA kids get bullied because there's a sense of like children not wanting anybody different around them. And so that was really tough. But I think it's also something that helps me understand what young people are going through. And, you know, I love the whole It Gets Better campaign, which was started by Dan Savage, who's amazing. And I think that really helps to sort of like think about us as generational, you know, like LGBTQI issues are generational. We can be generational, multi-generational, and we should address that.
What is the, because I've started hearing this like in the last week, the IA. What is the IA in
LGBTQ? It's intersex and asexual or aromantic. And so it's also like people who are born with a different set of ideas about like what gender they are, and also non-binary would fit in there as well. So that's sort of the plus. Non-binary is really an expression of gender that is your own kind of idea of what gender is. So there's a lot of the LGBTQIA plus community that is still growing, and still we're still trying to accommodate it all.
And I know for you, it's been hard to categorize you totally,
yes.
Right?
So I would be technically bisexual, although the bisexuality would denote that there's only two genders, which is wrong, because gender and its expression is infinite. So I don't like the term, although I do think that it's what we have in terms of the community. It's already in the flag. We're committed to it.
They just keep adding letters, though.
They just keep adding letters.
It's going to be the whole alphabet by the end of this.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what I love about it is the specificity, and that what is demanded of us when we look at like the way the community is and the diversity of it, we have to keep expanding because we're learning and more of an expression of who we are. We're discovering more about ourselves as we go along in history.
So that bullying as a kid, you didn't quite feel like you fit in. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably true of almost every stand-up comedian.
Oh, yeah,
not your exact experience.
Yes.
But for so many stand-ups, I mean, is that something that you guys all talk about? I mean,
yeah, of course, because we all have that really isolated thing. Because when you're a comedian, when you're born like one, you're probably born a comedian. I think comedians also are just kind of born comedians. You're born with it. You'll say things that really make people angry. You just do. You just say the one thing that is what you shouldn't say, and that's just our natural tendency.
Do you remember your first big laugh, the moment where you said, I got it?
I don't even know. I don't even know if I've had it yet. I think it still has yet to happen. It really hasn't happened yet for me. I'm not really sure. And I don't even know exactly why I ended up being a comedian, although I know I decided on it very young because I made the decision to be a comedian right after I realized that Wonder Woman was probably not going to happen. Like, I thought I was going to be Wonder Woman. And this is like the old Linda Carter Wonder Woman, too.
Right.
This is not the Gal Gadot, although I love the Gal Gadot Wonder Woman. Mm-hmm. But this is the one, the 70s or 80s Wonder Woman. Mm-hmm. But I quickly decided I couldn't do that, but I could be a comedian.
And were you bombing at the beginning? Mm-hmm. I mean, you were really young. Right?
I was about 14 years old. I was bombing. I bomb now. I bomb all the time. Like, that's the thing about comedy is that a lot of the time, comedians are not successful. Like, that's what's, I think, really funny about comedians that are really good because you're always kind of trying to stretch the parameters of what you're about and what you're able to do. And so you kind of come up against failure quite a lot, which I think it's honorable.
Is it in some way, like next week you're performing in Los Angeles, right? Mm-hmm. On next Friday at Largo.
Yes.
And tickets still available for that, for people that want to check that out. You know, Jerry Seinfeld has talked about when he walks into a room now, people start laughing because he's Jerry Seinfeld, but that lasts for a few minutes. Is it harder or easier now as a comedian having that sort of audience that's already with you and coming to your show?
Yes. Oh. You have to kind of handle whatever expectation is there. And yeah, Jerry Seinfeld's right because his fame will buy him about 2 minutes of a kind of like acknowledgement of like, okay, well, like, there's almost the formalities of here's this icon of comedies. Like, of course you're going to laugh, but you still have to make them laugh, even though your legend is there, your reputation is there, all of the things you've done. That all goes out the window if you can't deliver in the moment. So that's why comedy, stand-up comedy, is such a humble occupation because we really get broken down every day. It, sometimes it does not work. And it's not any fault other than we just have to continue to grow and expand. And sometimes that doesn't count for audiences who are having these expectations of who you should be or what should happen.
You know, folks watch The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Do you watch that show?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What, you know, you see the idea of this, of a woman coming into an all-man field. You're not only a woman, you're an Asian-American woman coming into this pretty much all-male field at the time.
Right.
There was nobody that really looked like you at the time that you were starting out.
Yes.
Now there are more people that look like you because of you.
Yeah, which
like
is great.
Like Awkwafina giving you a lot of credit.
Who I love, yes.
I mean, those early days when you walk into a room and there's all these, you know, guys that are, you know, maybe, you know, nasty, or, you know, what was that like? How do you deal with that?
I think people gave me a wide berth because I was so different and because I was so young that there wasn't a sense of like, oh, you know, why is this kid coming in here? I was actually pretty welcome because of the fact that this was such a novelty. This was such a something that, like, they'd just never seen. They'd never seen an Asian-American woman, much less a very, very young one. So it was kind of like, okay, there was something about it that allowed me to just sort of do what I was doing. Nobody was threatened by my, I guess, appearance, and nobody was threatened by, because I wasn't, I don't know, I guess I wasn't aware that I was the only one, or I wasn't aware that this was unusual. I didn't even think about it. I just wanted to do it.
So I find process to be so interesting. I know Joan Rivers, one of your idols, has talked about that she would write and had these note cards of all the jokes that she had for years, and other people go through different process. What's your process for getting ready for a show?
I think it's kind of, it's a little intuitive just because I've been doing it for so long, and I do try to do shows as much as I can, a few times a week if I can. So it's always right there, as immediate as possible. So I always kind of know, like, right when I'm going to open with what I'm going to do. I have a lot of notes scattered everywhere all over my life, whether it's like notepads or even on my phone, just like voice notes and, you know, whatever. It's all scattered everywhere. There's no like logic to it. And I just go and I try to perform as much as I can. So there's a sort of like a running list in my head of things that need to get done.
Are there topics that have been timeless that have always worked since you were doing them in the 90s? And are there topics that are not timeless that have changed a lot over the years?
I think what's probably timeless is talking about my family, talking about the Asian-ness of me, that kind of like the foreignness that I come from. And that immigrant thing that my family kind of offers up. So that's timeless. Maybe what's not so timeless, I don't even know. I think being mad at George W. Bush, I'm not mad anymore. I think he was a great president, actually. Now I'm like, he was awesome. Can we have him back? He deserves another chance. I mean, it's like a very, it's a weird place to be in because it's like, you know, who knows what's timeless now? I mean, at one point, and, you know, in comedy, sexism, racism, homophobia, these things were not acceptable. But, you know, these things are now kind of being sort of displayed out in the media in different ways, in politics, of course. And so it's weird. It's like, what is timely? What is timeless? Things change. It's very strange.
Did you ever run in the same circles as Donald Trump? Did you ever see him out? Did you ever,
no,
before he was president?
I know that I was an extra in Celebrity Apprentice because I was in the background when Cyndi Lauper was serving up hamburgers during her challenge in New York. And so I am kind of in the background. I never met him. I never met him socially. I know that he was around, but I never... I had some invitations to do Celebrity Apprentice, but I always turned it down just because it looked like they actually did a lot of work. It looked really hard. I would not want to actually work on anything ever, which is something that I know about myself. So, but he was telling my management that he was a big fan and wanted me on the show, but I couldn't commit to that kind of work. And then I was just as shocked as anybody when he was elected. I was really surprised. I'm still surprised. But, you know, here we are.
How do you think he's doing?
Well, I think what can be said is he is in way over his head. And it's it's hard for him to back up because he doesn't want to say that he was wrong to take the position in the first place. I think that he's just doubling down because he doesn't know what else to do. Looks desperate.
Do you think he wants to win a second term?
No, but I think it's just his ego is forcing him to continue.
Who do you like of the contenders?
You know, Elizabeth Warren is really impressive, and she's the person that I think has the most solutions. She's got a lot of plans, which I think is really important. You know, this is a very idealistic kind of thing of, like, to want to run. I mean, there's almost a feeling of, you know, we've got to get him out. Yeah, that's it. That's definitely true. We've got to have somebody. So everybody's kind of pushing forward. And, you know, I think there are a lot of really interesting candidates. There are a lot of candidates that I like. But and I've always loved Bernie Sanders. I think he's great. He's somebody that I've always been into. I just ran into Howard Dean the other week, and I was like, could you please just be president? You were really close to it before. He's great.
Yeah, well, we had, and Bernie Sanders was on the show last week.
Yeah, he's super cool.
So that, but that is kind of the big fight right now, and this is mm-hmm. something we'll talk about on the TV version of the show, too. This question of, okay, do we go all in to the left, or could mm-hmm. being all in on the left scare the middle? I mean, are you worried about swing voters in Pennsylvania and Michigan and Ohio and other places like that? If you do nominate Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, could mm-hmm. that scare people?
I know, and that's sort of like that famous now famous thing, the can't do's, the can't do voters, the can't do people, the can't do candidates. It's true. It's like, you know, that's kind of like old school politics when we sort of, before Obama, when we really paid attention to, like, well, we don't want to scare off people. We don't want to do things. We can't do that because, you know, and that's something that we thought went away with Obama, because Obama was really all about hope and change and realizing that we could have what we wanted. And so.
But Obama was also a moderate.
I mean,
he's talked about that. And we saw on display this week some frustration from people on the left that Obama was pretty much a moderate.
I know. But it's something like we've got closer than we ever have. And we got closer to that ideal that we can do. So I don't know.
Or yes, we can.
Yes, we can. We can.
Si se puede.
I want change. I mean, this election is more important than anyone that I think we've seen. And we've just got to figure out what we're going to do.
And you know, and race is such an important thing right now and at the heart of it. And I know so many people are feeling so hurt. I want to talk to you about that concept, too, because your show, All American Girl on ABC, was such a trailblazing show in the moment because, mm-hmm. you know, there's never been anything like that on TV before.
Mm-hmm.
And there have since been shows that have been, you know, followed in your footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering what the feedback was like for you during that time period. Did you hear from a lot of people that changed them?
It took a long time.
Seeing the representation on there? And what is that like for you to hear those stories?
Well, it was good because it took a long time for that effect to kind of have some importance, you know. Definitely when the show premiered, there was a lot of pushback from the Korean community because this was right after the LA riots. So they were very sensitive on how their image was going to be kind of projected.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was not very wholesome, I was a nightclub comedian, very raunchy, already very queer, very kind of on the edge, and also a woman, which is, you know, that counts for a lot too. So there was a lot of anger around the Korean community around my emergence in the show. And you know, it was really tough to battle that. And I think later, realizing that a lot of people saw themselves on television for the first time. It was the first time that they saw, like, Asian Americans on TV. So this was very profound for people like John Cho, people like Ali Wong, Awkwafina, Ken Jeong, all of these comedians that we're so excited about today, you know, that they really recognize themselves and they wanted to continue that conversation.
And some of the biggest stars in comedy right now.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
So I'm, like, so grateful for that.
One of my favorite roles that you've played, because I laugh just every time I see it, is Kim Jong-il from 30 Rock, which you were nominated for the Emmy for.
Yes.
Did you ever hear from Korea? North Korea?
Did you ever
hear from him? I mean, were you,
no.
And were you scared at all?
I was kind of scared. I think, but you know, it's like, I'm not going over there. Like, I'm not one of those, like, people who think that going there would be fun. I don't think it's going
to be fun. Especially
you. Yeah, not me. I'm not going. Yeah. And I just, you know, I think that it is like very monitored. You know, it even when I was trying to figure out how to play that role, I was trying to look up what he sounded like. And you don't have recordings or anything of his voice. You don't have an, I don't know why. It's so tightly controlled that we just have to make it up. And and so I'm nervous about it. I'm still nervous about it, but you know, you just never know what they're going to do.
That reminds me of like John Oliver. Have you ever seen when he plays Jared Kushner? Because Jared Kushner never does interviews, so he uses Gilbert Gottfried as the voiceover.
So good. It's so good. That's so good. Yeah, that's the perfect. That's the perfect. Yeah. Because
but
what
now
a great,
people use
what
your
great,
voice, I guess.
Yeah, you what a are, great voice to use.
You
yes.
are the voice. But then when you hear about, remember that the interview, right, with Seth Rogen and James Franco mm-hmm. and the massive hack of Sony, and that was right. all because of stuff that they did sort of in that similar vein, but nothing
exactly.
like that happened to you?
No. And which, you know, I mean, nobody can really hack me because I don't even know my passwords. So it's like, I don't know how to hack myself. It's like very, you know, it's kind of pays to be kind of, you know, bumbling and idiotic sometimes.
And so you're involved in a lot of stuff. I saw that you're working on a faith-based movie or sort of a movie
yes.
that's mocking some of that
which
world.
Which is very funny.
Tell us about
it's
that.
A movie that it's called Faith-Based, and it's about these guys who get the idea to make some quick money. They're going to make a movie, you know, about Christianity, or movie that is like sort of very Christian movie. I didn't realize there was a whole industry of like entertainment that's based in Christianity, that's faith-based.
Yeah.
So I play the head of Netflix type thing that's all Christ flicks. So right. it's very funny. I think it's a really good movie.
And a bunch of big stars signed up with that
yeah,
too, right?
Yeah, lots of cool people. I think Jason Alexander's in it. And lots of interesting folks. And it's a very, I think I kind of come from that world of, you know, my family is like super Christian, although they're not social conservatives because they had a business in a gay neighborhood that was a gay business. So it's not like that altered their view of gay people. You know, their Christianity didn't take away that, you know, that gay people was something was wrong with being gay.
So how do you square that, the religious world, and what role, if any, does religion have in your life?
Well, I think that, like, if I'm looking at it, the people who are really like evangelical Christians, those that are like kind of following Trump, it's so weird to me that they would be on board for all of the things that he's saying and doing, because Christ wouldn't do that. You know, if you live your life in the way that Christ would, as it's laid out in the New Testament, that you would do okay. You would be kind of nice. And I sort of think, well, if I wanted to be like a nice person, I would sort of maybe think to be Christ-like. I love a caftan. I love 12 guys around me. I think it's like a nice thing to sort of aspire to. Although I think that people are really kind of crazy. If you kind of look at like this book, basically the Bible is a book with a bunch of stories that don't really go anywhere, that are very much about crazy things that happen if you mix fabrics and you eat shellfish and stuff like that. So it's like, I don't know why you would take your life and make your life about that book and make your life about principles about that book. Maybe some of the things that Jesus did was really nice, and yes, that's good, but I don't know.
There's been a lot of great work that's been inspired by people in the church, though, right?
Well, what I love is like charity, people who are kind to other people, people who feed the hungry. Mm-hmm. That's a very, you know, that's a wonderful thing, and so that's great. You know, there's good things and there's a lot of bad things. Lots of bad things. I feel sometimes the bad things really kind of maybe outweigh the good things if you really look at it. But there's got to be a way around it. You know, people need a reason to live. I think that's why religion is so important to some people. But you sort of have to look at all of the things that it really means and what's being the actions being taken in the name of that religion.
So do you consider yourself an atheist, agnostic, Christian? What do you consider yourself? Because I know, clearly you love labels. That's one thing I'm
taking away
from
this. I do love a label. I would say probably agnostic with a atheist rising. So that's obviously not very atheistic if I have atheist rising.
But back to the sort of racial situation in the country right now. Mm-hmm. This is a question I asked Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders in the last week, which mm-hmm. is how do you put the genie back in the bottle? Because there's so much pain right now on all sides. I mean, a lot of Trump voters are angry, and clearly Democrats are angry, and you know, people are talking about rats and not being human in certain cities and all that. I mean, at one point, we are all Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, how can you sort of get back to some of that sense in this sort of divided world, this divided media world? What do you think?
I think that it helps to understand that everything that you do on social media is recorded, and therefore everything it feeds back to you every day is only stuff that you would want to see, somebody like you would want to see. So our news feeds are really kind of curated for us, for our phones are kind of molded to all of this thing, like it will reflect back to you the world that you want to see. And so a lot of that is kind of responsible for the way that we have such a divided country. We have such a divided view because all of the things that we get, like news and whatever, is like constantly kind of being filtered to what we think is right. And that goes for anything like any social media, anything like your, like, you know, site that you're getting news from, anything. It's like people just like what they like, and they're going to stay with what they like. And even advertising is sort of like curated to what you like. And so it's hard to look at the other side. It's hard to see them.
Do you actively search out conservative media?
I do, and then I get immediately angry. I do. I really do look at it, and then I'm like, well, you know, it's like people just, they don't understand. Like, they're not, I do actively try to search it out.
Do you have conservative friends or people that you really respect on the right that you have this sort of dialogue with?
You know what I have? What I have are old school, like, fiscal Republicans, and then, and like
the country club type.
Yeah, and like libertarians, like real, like kind of, and also a little bit. I have a little bit of like a doomsday prepper. There's some doomsday preppers in my family. There's people like around that are kind of like more on that side of like, we've just got to prepare, or that they want complete separation of government. You know, like they want complete like no government. So there's like anarchists in there. So I know people that are kind of on the fringe that I guess could go either way, you know, very left or very right. So it scares me. Like, there's so much out there that people think, like, this is all going to blow up, or that there's going to be a civil war. That's a really scary thought, too.
And I know you've talked about this some before, and maybe we wrap up with this, but how do you do comedy in the social media age? Because it's so different than when you started years ago. Or is it so different?
It is different, but it isn't. It is different, and it isn't. You know, you want to be compassionate. You want to be clear. You want to be, like, not taken out of context, which that's a nightmare. That's the worst. And I think you do, so it's hard to do it. Like, if, you know, social media is really about taking these sound bites, you can make anybody look terrible, you know, if you wanted to. So it's really like, you know, just being aware of that and conscious of that. Although maybe that hasn't changed so much because maybe media has always been like that and we haven't known, but it's hard. It's weird. But definitely it's a challenge.
Well, the most important thing you can do in the social media era is to download the Margaret Cho podcast,
yes!
Which is available now on Arios. Again, Margaret Cho is going to be performing at the Largo next Friday. And thank you so much.
Thank you for
sharing your view. Anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
This dog was so good this whole interview. She didn't even make a noise the whole time.
I don't know. How do you do that? What's your tips for dog owners? Because the dogs that we've had never would be able to do this.
Well, she's a rescue dog, so she's very grateful. I think she's just really happy to be around and happy to be included.
And I think she's a big fan of the Issue Is podcast.
She's a huge fan.
So she subscribes. She just wants to listen.
Yes.
I love that. All right. Well, at least we got one listener for this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Margaret Cho. Please subscribe to the podcast like the dog just did here. You can find us, search for The Issue Is, listen to some of our other previous conversations, and also download the other podcast we're publishing this week, which is Margaret Talking About Politics with Ben Lyons and Bob Schrum as well. Really interesting conversation. I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Margaret Cho. See you next time.